The condition of the waters. Or did class end yesterday? Perhaps. Okay. The condition of the waters. The creating agency, man, has through the incentives of a coordinating purpose, intense meditation, and creative activity, built the thought form which he is ensouling. Which he is ensouling with his own vitality and directing it with his will. Thus far this is done. A time has come for that thought form to be sent on its mission and to carry out the purpose of its being. As we saw in the earlier rule, the form is driven from its creator by the power of the expulsive breath. Yes, that, well, you know, we kind of used the Om. We could have done that, but sometimes the Om can be just as effective. Wow. The thought form is driven from its creator by the power of the expulsive breath. This is a symbolic statement, but at the same time, an experimental fact in magical work, and that has to be taken into consideration. Symbolic and also actual. In the disciple's work, there is often failure owing to his inability to understand both the esoteric and the literal significance of this expulsive breath. He's re-accentuating the idea that an expulsive breath is used in the process. But I've often thought to myself, you know, you can do that, but you can also expel the breath on the Om. And, of course, the idea of a concerted breath might actually correlate with the idea of driving the thought form from
it. When he says the esoteric significance of it, is that are you talking about more of an interior mental sort of expulsion?
I think so. But he's also telling us, don't overlook the literal possibility.
Yeah.
As he carries forward the meditation work, the expulsive breath is the result of a preceding period of rhythmic breathing. First, he's giving us actual physical instructions here. A preceding period of rhythmic breathing paralleled by concentrated meditation work as we are building the thought form. Then a definite focusing of the attention and the breath as the purpose of the creative form is mentally defined. Attention and breath as the purpose of the creative form is mentally defined. In other words, perhaps before it is sent forth, we have to remind ourselves of the purpose. And finally, the vitalizing of the thought form by its creator, and this is done through the eye, through the contemplative eye, and its consequent energizing into independent life and activity. It's in number 3 on page 22. So you already have that. Okay, up there, go into there and get number 3 on page 22. Okay, so let's look at this again because it's really one piece of instruction after another. We often fail because we don't get both the esoteric and the literal significance, and now he's telling us something about the literal significance. The expulsive breath is preceded by a preceding period of rhythmic breathing paralleled by concentrated meditation work. So we are breathing, meditating, building, and vitalizing before we send it forth. This paragraph should be highlighted.
Yeah.
Because it's really in terms of achieving the goal good instruction, or necessary instruction. first hindrance to the potency of the work comes from the failure of the disciple to carry on these activities simultaneously. Okay, so let's review. We have to breathe rhythmically. We have to build simultaneously. And we have to vitalize simultaneously with the building and the breathing. And that sets us up into a condition, and probably you would almost begin to feel when the moment had come for expelling the thought form in a dynamic way. The word expulsive would not be used if it was just a gentle outflow. You know, this probably has a lot of push behind it. And we have to renew our sense of purpose. Purpose, the vitalization of contemplation, rhythmic breathing, building, and then expulsion. And you can probably, each person will have to decide when enough work has been done before the expulsion occurs. Now, we remember that we are not given the full formula for effective detachment. Nevertheless, he's telling us that expulsion can be engaged in.
Michael, let me ask you something about that moment. Do you think that that's a one-time thing?
No. I don't. I think it could be, you know, in the totally accomplished creator who had brought his thought form as far as he could possibly bring it, knew the magical words, sent it forth, it's going to do what it's going to do, and I'm going to move on to something else. But for people like ourselves, I think we have to repeatedly send these things forth.
I think we have to imitate the solar angel. The solar angel keeps on going the Om, as it is said, or he puts forward the intention. So for us, being the really conscious creator or magician, we keep that point throughout the space all the time. And the more we remember it and we reconnect that and re-emphasize and re-magnetize it, the more powerful it becomes.
And the solar angel sends forth rhythmic streams,
right,
which we recognize as our, you know, so the solar angel just doesn't send something forth once. It sends it forth repeatedly and rhythmically. So
it's like our incarnation is said to be based upon that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That he is owning.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, okay, right. Let's just say that we should revisit the sending forth. I think that will be most effective. If we're trying to get something done in the world, then we can find ways to continue to refine the thought form. It will find other thought forms out there, and they will blend and merge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we use this technique using breath, meditating, pre-breathing, and then sending out thought forms that are selfish or personally oriented, you said that we don't get a mantra for detachment.
No.
If they're personal and if they're selfish,
they come back. Yeah.
And it's dangerous. It'll pollute our aura.
That's the idea that we've been gathering.
If it's unselfish and within the plan, and
within the soul stream,
lower, mm-hmm, then it'll go out and work out. And we won't have a karmic
link. Well, generally, ego and karma are related. I mean, we discussed this later. But if you center something on yourself, then that which is centered on yourself returns to self.
Mm-hmm. I have an extreme example of that. A woman that I was a fellow student with Rosalind and I. Was working with a guru, and she was also dealing with psychological issues with her family.
Uh-huh.
And the psychologist told her to spend some sessions formulating and expressing her rage. So
uh-huh.
She spent a half an hour or more sitting in her room expressing, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you."
Uh-huh.
And then proceeded to enter into her guru's meditation immediately following. And she had this horrible, dark, evil demon that she saw outside of enter into her and utterly destroy her life.
Well, she...
Gosh.
She set it up, huh?
She said she didn't. She's totally ignorant, and her
yeah.
guru didn't offer any information that was helpful in terms of how to avoid those kinds of things. If you meditate, everything will be fine.
Cautionary tales.
Cautionary tales.
Okay. All right. Anyway, this is an important paragraph. Let's, you know, we ponder it and see how we can simultaneously operate in this manner. Yes.
Another thought in regards to Bill's question. When we're working with the will, there's a certain sense of effectiveness of the will, and so it is. When you do something with the will, it's accomplished, and you accept its accomplishment. If we go back and try and redo it over and over, it's kind of saying, well, we probably didn't do it right that time, let's try it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there may be a combination of clear-cut steps, but also that continual nurturing of the thought form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go through a threshold, but that doesn't mean that we retract our attention or whatever from it. We constantly are nurturing it, even though that threshold step may not need to be repeated.
That's a good clarification, because that's sort of what I was thinking about, actually, that I didn't express. But, you know, once it's sent forth.
Yeah, but you know, in a way, it's still on your mind. Still on your mind, too. You know, suppose you're working with building a thought form in the world, and you send forth the idea, and that this should work, or an idea for service. New refinements may come in, and you know, new ideas may adhere to the original, and they may need to join the original. In other words, that's why I said that if you were absolutely sure that you had completed every aspect of the thought form, then you're finished with it. But human beings, as they are working in phased production of something. So it may be necessary to add the good new ideas to the original, and if you send them forth, they will rather join the original. They'll be attracted to it.
That's what I mean by nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when a child is born, we don't just let him on his way and
he's gone forth, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first hindrance to the potency of the work comes from the failure of the disciples to carry on these activities simultaneously, so they have to practice, you know, even just practice rhythmic breathing while we are sounding the om and building the thought form. There's a number of activities, and DK is really one who urges harmonious simultaneity upon us in many meditative processes. He says this is not just linear. This is simultaneous. When you're doing the Antikarana meditations, he's telling us, I know I'm giving you a lot that you have to do all at the same time. Just learn to do it. Okay. The second cause of failure lies in his neglecting to consider the condition of the waters. Or the state of the emotional substance into which this mental form must go and so gather to itself the matter of the astral plane which will enable it to become a functioning entity on that plane. Now, of course, you know, we also want, you know, water is matter, and we also want to have our mental matter in pretty good shape while we're building the original thought form, but generally, in this rule, when he says condition of the waters, he's focusing on those waters which are astral, not which are...
Within himself, right? Not so much what's on the outside?
At first here, within himself.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly enough, in the glamour meditation, you do not attack a glamour within your own aura. You attack it out there, on the astral plane. That's different. In the glamour meditation we've been using, the technique of light, you find the glamour on the astral plane and not within the astral body. It's your own glamour, but you deal with it as if it's general. General. But it's the condition of your waters and not the condition of the astral plane that's of moment here. If it cannot do this, it becomes simply and eventually a dead form on the plane of mind. So if it can't go down into the astral plane and gather the necessary material, it will just stay on the mental plane, a dead form on the plane of mind, and it will lack the motivating power of desire, which is necessary to carry it forward to completion on the physical plane. And then, of course, you think motivating power of desire is very much like Mars, you know, which is the one who carries things forward. Mars, the astral plane, and the power to carry forward towards manifestation, which is also ruled by Mars. Mars is very important in this whole process in terms of getting something to go forth. Even in the process of birth, if you look at it, Scorpio, which is associated with that process, is ruled by Mars. All expulsions are ruled by Mars. Okay. So it's important that, you know, let's just say the thought form must be animated by the desire for its appearance. We must care that it appear. Okay, so what does he say here? If the condition of the waters are such that the thought form cannot really work properly, the emotional substance into which this mental form must go and so gather to itself matter of the astral plane, which will enable it to become functioning on that plane. If it cannot be rendered functioning on that plane, that's what he's saying. If it cannot do this, and I'll just put the explanation, if it cannot be rendered functional on the astral plane, then the following. It becomes simply a dead form on the plane of mind. I'm sure we all have a lot of dead wood up there on the plane of mind. Stuff lying around from many books, unused thought forms, obsolete thought forms. You know. So.
I guess what to do is a way to do clean up.
I think so. You know, with certain mantras, even of our own making, you know. Even to say that I expel from my mental aura all that is non-essential. Oops, nothing there.
I think this stage has a lot to do with tranquility. That we have a note, it's still a very subtle note that we're trying to attract denser substance to, and if we're in a state of tranquility, that note can be sound within that substance. But if the emotions are just filled up and whirled, it's just lost in the turmoil.
Yeah, it's just the noise. Astral noise can obscure the descending note. Now, you know, hopefully that little point of light is sounding a note fairly faithful now to the original egoic intent, and we want to swell that note. The form swells and grows, you know. We want that note to swell and not to be interfered with, or as they say, it can be, the word is often drowned out. His voice was drowned out, you know, the note disappeared within the sounds disappeared within the sound. It can be either positive or negative, but in this particular case, we don't want it submerged. We don't want our note submerged by the chaos of the astral plane.
Yeah, the second of that, though, isn't it just, I hate to use the word depression, it would be sound too strong, but you talked about this guy saying how dark it was in his meditation. It strikes me that people who end up repeating things over and over again, nothing's happening. Something is actually misses what Krishnamurti normally gives.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a aliveness on the astral plane. I mean, one thing's turned out, as I was talking about, but the other is just, there's got to be something lively, something I would say happy.
Well, there's got to be incentive.
Right.
You know, you have to want or desire or aspire to have this thing.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean incoherence.
No, not at all. Yeah. No, but at least it's some
supported. Kindness. Sure. Yeah. It's got to be supported by the astral condition. All right, so she was first.
You know, I do remember reading how we have so many of these, you know, half vitalized thought forms and so much kind of debris or whatever you call it in our field. And I wonder if did he give any more specific meditation about how to clear that?
I'm not recalling that there is a specific meditation, but through the power of your visualization, you could imagine it.
Yeah.
There's a place called Deadwood, South Dakota.
Deadwood.
I think I've been there.
Wild Bill Hickok, I think he was shot in the back in Deadwood. Right. You make a pilgrimage to that saloon, draw a magical circle.
Leave it right there.
All right.
Michael, I just wanted to say in response to what Sheldon was saying, in one of Lucille's books, dealing with the creative process, she says that the only, at this stage, the only emotion permitted is love. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, it's a good thought, and let's see how it blends in with all this. Emotion. Okay. Permitted at this stage is love. But of course, you know, sometimes it's possible. And then, you know, I wouldn't discount aspiration. You know, this whole idea of fiery aspiration, because it seems to me that's not a negative thing. He does take it far forward into the evolutionary process, not just like you only have it before the second degree. It's something that the yogi is animated with. So, which doesn't negate love, of course. Doesn't negate love. But it is interesting to remember this. If a thought form is sent forth into the emotional world to gather to itself a body of desire, the impelling force which produces all objectivity, so this really is something Martian here, Mars or Neptune, and is immersed in a condition of the waters which can be described as purely selfish, all that occurs is as follows. Now this is very interesting. So now a thought form is being sent into a selfish emotional body. It is lost by being drawn into the astral body of the disciple, which is the focal point for all astral energy employed by the disciple. It is swept into a vortex of which the individual astral body is the center and loses its separate existence. It's overcome, it's drowned, it's obscured. The simile of a whirlpool is of value here. The thinker is like a man throwing a toy boat from the shore into a stream of water. If he throws it into a whirlpool, it is sucked in time into the central vortex and so disappears. Many forms thus constructed by an aspirant in his meditation work are lost and fail in their objective because of the chaotic and whirling state of an aspirant's emotional body. You know, control the body of the motion for the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life. Shut out the sun, let's see, engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun, and render all plans futile. That's the third counsel in White Magic. It's 473. So, okay, so serenity, love, calmness, reflectiveness, all of these make sure that there is not a distortion and a destruction of the thought form descending. Thus good intentions come to naught, thus good purpose and planned work planned upon the mental plane. For the master, planned work for the master failed to materialize because as the thought form passes downward onto the plane of desire and emotion, it contacts only the seething waters of fear, of suspicion, of hatred, of vicious or purely physical desire. What a pretty picture. I suppose it's possible to have good thoughts and still have kind of an unconscious astral condition which is very turbulent and inimical to the safe passage of your thought form. These being more potent than the little form, drown it. And it passes out of sight and out of existence, and the man becomes conscious of another abortive effort. So I guess this is the, what's he calling it, the condition of the waters. Important. And preliminary to the real creative process. So I suppose, as we're sitting down or standing to grade, whatever, we don't want to be in a state of chaotic emotional agitation as we are undergoing this. So meditative attitude, you know, we've given so much about the tranquilization of the astral body, and as we approach the second initiation, it's Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune. From Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune, you're not going to get a whole lot of disturbance when they work together. If you add Mars to the mix, or Mercury, or Pluto to the mix, you can get a lot of disturbance. In other words, we have to quiet both the mind and the astral body to be an effective magician. Or again, so this is what we call, let's just put it in here, drowning the thought form in turbulent astral waters. Do you have any experience in your life of having done that?
No.
You know, of you have a good idea, or even you say, well, I'm just not in the mood for this right now. It's a good idea, but I can't handle this right now, you know. I'm too upset. And then when you quiet down, then maybe it has a chance to get through.
And yet, sometimes in those periods of great turbulence, if you can hold the light, if you can hold the thought, it is really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
When you...
Very motivated. You're very motivated. Because out of the turbulence can come a very one-pointed desire that this make its way through.
Yeah. So that was shy away from, you know, it always have to feel good.
Yeah, but then basically what you have to do is subdue the turbulence and change it into one point of aspiration.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think about how this works. I mean, I guess for me I would have to say love of the idea to be manifested. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's again not discounting the attitude of love in the astral body, but I do think that a very strong aspirational stream is needed to bring it through. You know, when people want to do something and are terribly motivated to want to do it, they often do it, no matter what, come hell or high water. So at least it's applicable. I mean, I suppose maybe there have been some things that you have done in your life against odds, and against the advice of many, and even against your own fears and in inhibitory states. But you knew it was right, you wanted to do it, and you brought it through somehow.
If someone said that you should do exactly what you most fear.
Wow. It has been often said, if you fear the heat, go to the heart of the furnace. I remember an old television show with Alan Watts. Somehow, I guess that's going back to the days when it all seemed to start, right? And he was describing the Eastern wisdom of going to the heart of the furnace if you feared the fire or the heat. There's another one, you know, if you're afraid of ghosts, go to the graveyard at midnight. and refrain from whistling. Well, the old saying about whistling past the graveyard. You know how people, just go there and face it, right? And that's what a lot of those horrible Eastern demon masks are all about, to get you to face those things. It's a bit like
within yourself.
Right. It's the Medusa story. You know, everyone's carrying their own Medusa with hissing snakes for hair. But we're given some advice in the Perseus legend: polish up the mirror of your mind, which is your shield. Because if you're not ready, you know, it can turn you to stone. It can freeze your whole psychological process. But if you have a good interpretive mind, you can analyze your Medusa in the light of your shield and cut off its head. So you never look at the Medusa directly. Or again, the condition of the waters is not that of a self-engendered whirlpool, but is more allied to that of a pool stirred into a frothy and boiling surge through the activities of others. In other words, you know, sometimes we blame people for how they, you made me do it, you know, but something from you upsets me. Well, we oftentimes say that. I mean, really, it's irresponsible to say it. But suffice it to say that other people do affect us, whether or not they should.
That is the key to the second initiation, is even though they are,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Smile and laugh.
Yeah, if it's really gone through you in that way. Obviously, we can do that on the surface of things and still be like this, you know. So is there inconsistency between what we're feeling and what we're showing?
Yes.
Or do we really say, well, you know.
Hopefully the outer will then help the inner dissipate.
Congruence.
If the outer comes out and you start spewing, you only fuel your own flame.
If they say if you do dam it up, it'll come forth doubly strong in the future. So all words retained and suppressed without being understood come forth in a future torrent, much augmented.
And so, what do I do?
Understand.
Mental plane.
To get the understanding.
The mental plane, being on the mental plane, can dissipate that glow on the astral.
Sure, if understanding comes, you know, rather than blame. Yeah.
I was going to say that sometimes there is also room for just naming and saying what things are, so being in truth, more like being in the first rate kind of response to the situation without getting all entangled in it by just taking.
Yeah. Well, these are often I messages. You know, you don't say, you have, you know, say, my impression, my response to what I see here, this is my perspective, I share my perspective, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody can say you can't have your perspective.
And it's unconditional love, because we don't always know the big plan.
No.
So you keep on doing everything you can, but it's unconditional love to not judge.
Sure, and that, of course, that's tough when people are setting themselves against things we hold dear. Our ideals, you know, our enemies. You know, this is the old love thy enemy. Well, but really, understand thy enemy. The understanding has to come first, really. And he says somewhere, to understand all is to forgive all.
Yeah.
Something of that nature. So obviously we are deficient in understanding. We don't know the history of the souls involved or why they are engaged as they are engaged. They're in a state of limitation, and I'm sure we appear that way to others. Their limitation is obvious to us. How did they get there? Why are they there? Why are they frozen there? Why can't they move on? We should understand these things.
Sometimes I think that the understanding opens the door for amazing truths, and that is how we set free.
Sure, that's really important. So, you know, we're ready to attack, we're ready to blame, we're ready to negate the position of the other guy. You know, just think about these, you know, what bothers me a lot these days is that as I see these guys over there blowing up girls' schools. Mm. You know what I mean? A girl can't get an education. See what I mean? I want to kill them. You know what I mean? You know, but okay, you know, this is my first response, and you know, give me a weapon, but okay. What's the? How did this arise? What is their stage of evolution? That doesn't mean that one tolerates the behavior, because one has to be forceful against that kind of behavior. But at least not to hate. Remember in Star Wars, at the end with the evil emperor, one of those things, you know, he was really happy when he was getting Luke Skywalker to hate, you know, come on, let's hate, you know, let's do that. So, the real warrior doesn't hate, does what is required, and doesn't have, as Tui often says, does not have the taste for blood. Executes, but does not have the taste for blood. Not hating. So if you hate, already you're defeated. You can oppose out of principle, but not hate. So, you know, when I feel this visceral response, I say, you know, I put my daughter or my, you know, children in that kind of school, and now they can't have an education because some idiot, you know, believes a certain version of what Muhammad said, you know. So one must really restrain. And then, of course, substitute other things. And stop that also.
And that is exactly the method of the Black Lords. They want different parties to hate each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in the martial art, the white martial art, it is that that one rule that the warrior loses his power. In that split second when their hatred appears.
Well, this is the way of the warrior in the Native American medicine wheel.
Yeah.
The term that they apply to that place on the medicine wheel, which is in the South in the tradition that I learned, is innocence.
Right.
Okay? You must be innocent in order to go to war.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. you cannot hate your enemy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so, you know, we probably... In this hateful world, I think David Spangler wrote something lately that was passed around. You know, he really was warning about this condition of great fear and hatred which was existing, and how it had to be neutralized while still standing for principle. Yeah.
I think often part of understanding is understanding our own role in a dynamic. You know, somebody's in our face, and even if we're trying to understand him and all of that, it's often a reaction, and, you know, Bush's famous, was it George Bush's famous question, why do they hate us? You know, mm-hmm. there are many reasons that if we examined our own conduct in the world, we could understand better why it is that certain mm-hmm. things happen.
Sure, sure. Got to deal with the enemy within, and also the whole factor of projection, and as DK and many psychologists have said, you know, when you're criticizing another person's behavior, it's because it's in you. Mm. Though perhaps not to the same extent, but there's a seed of it in yourself, at least to watch that.
So that's different than analysis.
Than
analysis.
Analysis.
Something truly.
It's a recognition.
Because like the master, if we think about DK, he criticizes many things, and one cannot think that he
he recognizes what it's all about, and he may have the memory of what it was. We really must understand the origin of any state, and it kind of takes a highly developed soul to do that. But let's move forward. Okay, there are many disciples who have achieved a fair measure of self-control and of personal disinterestedness. They are not.
I just love that word, fair measure. It gives us all a great deal of hope.
He speaks proportionally, you know. So he's cautious not to say they have achieved total self-control and personal disinterest. No, rather a goodly amount. Okay, they are not victims of personality, desire, and aims, and are comparatively free from the whirlpool of selfish tendencies. But their astral bodies are again and again swept into a state of agitation by the group for and in which they work. Group conditions. Okay, group conditions. Okay. Sound familiar?
Yes.
They are elated or depressed, satisfied or dissatisfied by the results they achieve or fail to achieve. This achievement or lack of achievement and the steadiness or disloyalties of their fellow servers produce agitation and emotional upset. Steadiness or disloyalty. I mean, we talk about each other. and we criticize each other's behavior in the group, possibly. And on this powerful reaction, their thought forms, constructed so diligently and prayerfully, come to naught. So, another, let's see, more rocks on which to shatter the ship. Their skill in action is lost because they are tied to the desired result, and so their labor produces nothing. So, without these D words, basically detachment from group conditions and from whether they succeed or fail. Well, in other words, we're told to work without attachment to results. In other words, to do the right thing, regardless of opposing conditions and other people's opinions. And he gives us these four counsels in White Magic. He says, obey the inner impulses of the soul. Inquire the way, obey the inner impulses of the soul, pay no attention to worldly wisdom. I'm paraphrasing. In other words, you're going to have to run against the counsel of the best and wisest all the time. In the worldly sense, the best and wisest worldly counselors all the time. And then set an example. So, in other words, we're getting the idea that that our astral condition is really important in this question of whether we're going to be a skillful creator. Yeah?
I was just trying to superpose that individual activity to the group. It seems like in the group there has to be some discussion, rapport, feeling through the issues, working it through.
Yeah, but avoid upset. Upset really is a turbulent, disintegrative condition. So can we work things through in the group without upset? In a state of agitation and non-serenity, this is like, it's a fourth-rate condition of turbulence. Serenity is needed. Is it possible to be serene and highly motivated at the same time? Is it possible to be serene and aspire at the same time? Must aspiration render one turbulent, or can aspiration accompany serenity and love? In a way, if I look at the aspiration of the Christ or the aspiration of a Buddha, I think it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
Think about the Buddha's aspiration to achieve what he achieved. And was he always going off and getting angry in the process?
I think this is an area where we can see two different methods of working. Just a little while ago we were talking about if someone really, 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 really desires something, they will probably achieve it. I think this is a little different, where the desire is not one's desire to see something succeed. It could be a wonderful, unselfish thing, but the divine desire for it to manifest, the detachment that the Creator approaches it, so that he's not sucking the vitality out of whatever it is that is emerging here because of his own desire to see it happen.
Sure. And it's possible also to align one's own personal desire with the desire to see something higher that is willed happen.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, personal desire is often like selfish desire, but if the soul has a desire, I mean, we're often told, heart's desire, soul's desire. Desire is a factor that even the monad has. Desire with the big D. We cannot eliminate desire from our secondary solar system. But we can certainly choose our desires, and we can see if we can be aligned with higher desires.
Yeah, I think that's the point, too, you was making yesterday, that it's the desire of the soul, that the soul is the creator. And we can align our desire with that.
Yeah, because...
Right. a lot of apparent paradoxes here and contradictions. One can have, you know, intense aspiration and even desire without becoming turbulent and upset. It's just a different condition altogether. And probably when will influences the astral body, that's what is going to happen. They will begin to blend and merge.
Well, I think that desire is like ambition. It can be a great thing. I mean, look at Jesus, look at Moria.
Well, it depends on, but ambition usually implies some egocentrism. See, maybe not. What Master Hilarion says, be not ambitious, but work as those who are ambitious. Mm-hmm. You're right in the beginning of The Light on the Path. It has some marvelous things of how you must have the same kind of intensity as people who are driven by their ego, and yet you are not. Yes.
It seems like there's a question of obedience that comes into play. You know, I am the father I was, I've got my ambition, but I subjugate that to the higher purpose.
And who is the I that has the ambition? You understand that people at this stage don't have that I anymore in the same way. So, you know, it's like a great desire is working through one, and who is the one through whom it's working? One has identified as the soul. So the stage of identification here is very important. You know, if the little ego is running the show, it is a little vampire, like we said. It can drain the energy off. It's like pretending to be the soul. Like William Meador often talks about the imposter. You know, you got the idea, you got the theory now, so you act as if you are the soul. But you're not. You're still the personality pretending to be the soul. You haven't really identified as the soul. So, you know, think about your deepest desires. Right now, think about that. You know, what's driving you, and is this something for you, or is this something that I'm not going to ask you to talk about it, but I'm just within your own. No, I know where that can go. No, but within what's driving you, is it a personal drive? Or is it a plan aligned drive, a soul aligned drive? And where does your own desire body fit with it? See, what's trying to happen through you that's not of you? See, who is the you that's involved in this desired process? Have you become enough the soul so that the little misrepresentation of the soul, we call the lower ego, is getting pretty smaller, like just like the M in the big circle? Remember when you sound the Om, big M, little M, dot, over time. See, this is just like asking, who's the creator, and are you, the white magician, the agent of that creator? And is the desire of the soul, or the will of the soul, the main thing that's at play here? Or are you asking something for your separated self? However subtle that process might be, because it can be subtle. You know, the lion is always escaping out the other end of the cave. In the labors of Hercules, right? Mm-hmm. You board it and then the lion has gone out and he's outside there again. So you have to board up both entrances to the cave. The ego is the slipperiest thing. as we learn when we are proud of our humility.
And so I pick up one of the side of this, because I see it so often in somewhat uncontrolled environments, like a business environment, where the group astral body really is disturbed. And somebody is trying, say a nurse is trying to create a condition, you know, in a hospital, and the thing is just, and she's being swallowed up by what's going on. We've seen, and I'm sure you all have too, people are able to speak words of power. And sometimes it goes to leadership positions. Let's give you one obvious example. Say two groups are merging, saw on TV recently, by the way, and the boss then comes in and says, look, people, I know this is a time you're all frightened, you're all concerned about your jobs, you're all thinking about competing with one another. Our mission, though, is to save lives.
Mm-hmm.
And if we focus on that mission, we're going to find the right place for everybody here in the hospital and do the best we can. All of a sudden, there's a wave that passes over and somebody speaks those kinds of words for a right. purpose. Right. Those are magical words, in a sense, for the group astral body.
Right.
So, and I think this has been discovered by a lot of leadership studies that have been going on. Some people really have this ability to speak those words and convey them authentically.
And that's really on purpose, too, isn't it?
So yeah.
It takes away from the secondary factor, which is the form, and rivets the attention on the reason for being. Mm-hmm, yeah.
I was reflecting on the nature, the slippery nature of the personality, and how we can, I think, we can work on getting the desired nature of the personality aligned with the desired nature of the soul. But kind of try to because in the end, the goal is of manifesting love and consciousness in life for humanity and for the individual being can be aligned.
Mm.
And I'm just saying that there is a place where we can meet the needs of the personality, of the separated one, if it puts it surrenders its existence to the needs of the whole, because it will be taken care of in that bigger existence.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's right. Somehow in the Bible it's there that don't worry about what you shall wear or what you shall eat and blah, blah, blah. Your Father knows you have need of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The lilies of the field. Look at the lilies of the field, how they are.
Toil not nor spin. And, yeah. So it's really putting first things first in a way.
Yeah.
And it's living on purpose. And I think many things are taken care of when we do that. And don't worry about the secondary results. If we're really concerned about how all those things in the environment will support us, if we act on purpose, then we're putting the cart before the horse and our success rate will be reduced. Let's go on. There are many other conditions of the waters which each aspirant can for himself supply. There is one more, however, which I would like to touch upon. The emotional body of the disciple, which must feed and nurture the baby thought form with its mental nucleus. He drops little descriptors in here. So if you gather them all together, you really get a good picture of the process. The emotional body of the disciple, which must feed and nurture the baby thought form with its mental nucleus, is necessarily part of the planetary emotional form, and hence vibrates in unison with that form. This should also be carefully considered, for the emotional body is thrown into a state of activity by the general astral condition, and must be handled wisely from this angle. There's oftentimes, it's kind of the same thing as public opinion, only you might call it public emotion.
Yeah.
There are waves of different kinds of emotions that sweep through and over people. Like we saw the other day in the movie, the waves of fear, which came over that weekend when things were being forced upon people. And we have to, Master Moria said, pay a lot of attention to atmospheric condition. Every leader must pay attention to the atmospheric condition, because this condition will affect his people. And now we're talking about the emotional atmospheres, which are generally ambient. The what do we call it? The atmosphere in the country, the atmosphere in the city, and whatever. At this time, there are three qualities predominating in the planetary form: fear, expectancy, and a climaxing desire in the human family for material possession. The three. So these are in the astral body of humanity, right? It seems. I think this concerns the astral body of the planet. Whoopsie. Wherever we were. This concerns the astral body of the planet and of humanity. Okay. Fear, expectancy. Of course, on this expectancy, good or bad things can come. We all expect the world to come to an end in 2012. We expect that the Imam Mahdi will return amidst fire and flame, which will put down all other civilizations and will exalt Islam. We expect that Armageddon will soon be at our door, and the good Christians, 144,000 of them, will be saved, and others will go to hell. We have expectancies. Some have better expectancies than these. But anyway, you know, something's coming is in the aura of the human thought. And I think we all share this. I mean, well, because, you know, there's something in us, some antenna which knows this is the case. Something is coming. And we've been told about it rationally by the Tibetan and other seers. So we have fear and we have hope for better. And then, of course, part of fear is, I want all I can get so I will be safe and satisfied. Yeah.
Well, Michael, there also, last night on the television was a huge program on History Channel about 2012, and you had the two opposing results opinions, and one of them really was about, in their opinion, their research, that the Mayans and other groups that came from Atlantis put forth the fact that 2012 is certainly not the end, but to the beginning of a new birth for mankind.
Sure,
and that's what they were telling us to get ready for by doing this kind of work.
I think that most rational people are accepting that point of view rather than the endless end of the world scenarios, you know. You were going to say?
Well, I read an article which at the time I thought was interesting, but I didn't find any confirmation of the argument. And then later I found it in another source. And this article said that if we examine words that people use, we can predict what is coming in the future.
For them? Or for everybody?
For the world.
Okay.
And so, and you can do that through computer programs.
Right.
And so,
interesting.
It was said that this financial crisis, this financial meltdown, was actually already in people's auras, in their psyche. They were feeling it subconsciously, and the language reflected that.
Oh.
There were, like, the increased number of words such as uncertainty, poverty, fear, joblessness, and so on and so forth. And so now they're researching the language, the words we're using now at this moment.
What's it showing?
It's showing coming disasters of some kind of global magnitude in terms of either tornadoes or earthquakes or volcanic eruption, some sort of.
Yeah, I think there are a huge number of negative expectations in the air at this moment, and also a number of enlightened expectations. And basically, I suppose it's our responsibility to feed the enlightened expectations.
But, you know, this is so in the time. In the time, because the Pluto is, it is about that, and it's collective consciousness. We respond to these energies, and we cannot help or that something, some kind of this kind of things will also happen. And but that's why the disciples has to be strong, that we understand it and we hold that magnetic point in that so that the most is happening on the mental plane or within.
Mm-hmm.
But it can manifest also much harder, because all of us, we know when the Buddha has done something, how drastic it is, and so it can mean in collectively for humanity too.
And although these things may be emerging, it's our task to lay the emphasis on what lies on the other side, which is the new civilization, the presence of the Christ, and the hierarchy, and the redemption of humanity under Aquarian impulses, the seventh time that the seventh ray and Aquarius have occurred since the beginning of the Aryan age. So there is and if we can help people literally see through the obstacles arising, we will be doing some good. Yes. Yes, Diane, yes.
That honest point really brings up the whole thing which we're going to be getting into at some point, is this power of speech.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Indeed.
And
yeah.
So we might not consciously recognize what's going to happen, but something wells up in us and we may say, I'm afraid that, or something like that comes up, and
yes. Yes.
We're reactive to something else that's present.
Yes.
Which means that each is kind of doing two things. It's showing us what might happen, given certain conditions that are arising. But it also is assisting it in happening by the fact of speaking.
Sure. Exactly. So speech is energy. Thought is energy, and we have to decide where we put these things. So. You have something, and then you have something?
Just very quick. How long is Pluto present, or what?
Till 2024.
Just before the meeting of hierarchies.
And don't forget Neptune in Pisces.
Oh,
yeah.
Next year.
Prolia.
So actually, Pluto ends the time of the forerunners.
But look for the meaning of Uranus and Aries coming up very soon. Because then a lot of really good new ideas are going to emerge that can will be forward looking and can help us get through things. That's a it's next year, isn't it? Pluto, Uranus in Aries. When does Uranus go into Aries? Is it not? All you got to do is just take. I'm sure it's almost there.
When does it happen?
You know, we should, every one of us, we should really see what is our role in that, because some will act those new things, and some will have to work within the darkness, hold the light there. And it's a hard work, but because that... Who's responsible is that, because it is the most of us is going to work in that, because that's why we were sent for.
Well, Pluto's behind the scenes, but it also brings out all the truth.
That's right.
Sure.
It helps the new beginning.
The old that's civilization right. is being swept away, you know. Mm-hmm. Pluto destroys, Neptune dissolves, Uranus and Aries gives you new ideas. May 28th. We'll get together for a Uranus and Aries party. Subtract 84 years from now. What do you arrive with? About 1936?
Yeah.
Is that about right? 70 or 60? Yeah. 67. No, maybe it's 1926. 70, 84, 1926. Is that about when that... Let's just try 1926 for fun. Crash hadn't happened yet.
Bauhaus was just coming up in Germany, enlightening the art world and the design world.
Mm-hmm. So let's just take a look here. One.
Prohibition was 1924 to 26.
Yeah. Well, I think we. That humanity had an opportunity. What this is pleasant. Wait a second. Maybe it's going to be. Hold on.
Yeah.
If you see Uranus going into Aries, just let me know. It might be 1927.
That's the last time that what?
Well, 84 years ago, approximately 84 years ago. There you go. That's it. In April of 1927.
What happened?
Well, Uranus went into Aries. I mean, many things happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess what I'm saying, of course, Pluto just emerged at that time too. Pluto emerged a few years later, and the mobilization of the mass consciousness for negativity occurred. That was Pluto in Cancer. Now that was the lunar nature. Now we've got Pluto in Capricorn, and the power of the hierarchy can begin to make itself felt, as well as all the hellish things that could come.
Pluto in Capricorn right now?
Oh yeah. It's definitely there. But anyway, look, Uranus in Aries is a huge first ray. Uranus is the major first-ray planet, Aries is the major first-ray sign, and it's all about the new. Now, in this particular case, it led into a period of great war. But it was the period in which certain new ideas were appearing, and they didn't have to be good ideas either. They just arrived on the scene, and they swept over certain nations. Now, we have the choice ahead of us, whether there will be good new ideas that are seized upon or the other. But it will be very impulsive. I mean, impelling.
Well, Michael, you just said Pluto goes in May 28th. When did
Uranus? No, I didn't say that. No. I didn't say that. I said Uranus in there. Pluto has been in there already for a while.
And Aries?
No, hold on. Hold on. Pluto has been in Capricorn and will be until the 2024. And Uranus is now in Pisces. If you ever wonder why you're getting health care reform, that's it. And we'll go in May 28th. It will also retrograde, okay? It will also go back into Pisces. But then before long, by 2011, it'll probably be fully there. I don't want to digress. We have work to do. Digressions are interesting. You can spend your life with interesting things. Some digressions just. All right, now, but just follow good old Uranus here, and you see that already by December, it retrograded back. August, it didn't stay long. You know, there it's in Aries in July, June and July, and now it's retrograde. But finally, by 2011, it comes and stays. And I think that we're right there, you know, right around spring 2011, and I think we really need a new vision with that Uranus in Aries. The new inventions, the possibility of saying, look, we just got to start fresh here. New technology, you know, new energy sources, but we've got to use it right because the other side will also use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the point.
Okay, anyway.
Just one more about the solar. Pisces,
again, will stay also until about 2024, 2025.
We're in there now.
No, it's coming in another year.
Oh.
It's a 14-year period. It's probably 2011.
Well, what month in spring 2011, Michael, please?
Yeah, but I don't want to go look.
Oh, yes.
Okay. No, I don't want to go look. But Tuya has all of this, so talk to her.
Yeah.
All right. Otherwise, I'll just take time away from what we've got to do. But what the important thing is, realize the meaning of these three positions. Neptune in Pisces is the Christ sense of things, and Pralaya, dissolution, dissolving, fading away. It is as if it is floods. Now, you know, floods will occur on the emotional plane, and there may be the whole issue about global warming and certain places being covered by the waters. Watch out for being covered by the waters, whatever that means to you. It's like it's like the last days of Atlantis. So it's a cheerful thought. Now, Pluto. What about Pluto and Capricorn? The power structures break down. Also, compulsion, enforcement, all that kind of thing. It's not a very freedom-loving position. At the same time, the obstacles are destroyed. And what about Uranus and Aries? Doesn't take there very long. Let's get those new ideas front and center so we can emerge from the flood.
And think about the power of Pluto, because America has a special relationship with Pluto in Capricorn, because when the last time Pluto was in Capricorn, United States was established.
American Revolution.
And immediately when Pluto went to Capricorn 1 year ago, what happened last year?
The elections of November.
Oh, yes. And then what happened?
The crashes and so forth.
So that is how it is functioning. And from that we don't see that the unseen new streams which are now working, because if we think about that, we listen those thinkers who have been raising their voice that we have to create a new system, economical system, it is working there.
Mm-hmm. Michael, Uranus moves fairly slowly, is that correct?
7 years is all you'll get.
So the 2011 through 2018,
something like that. You know, you'll have about 7 years from 2011, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet Pluto and Capricorn will last until 2020.
Because they're 25 years in a sign off. It's much different.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, we're going to live through these large large issues here. Aries, Sagittarius, Scorpio, Virgo.
Why do you think that? I just want to throw out, I encountered some material on the 2012 stuff to point out the fact that it's not a one-time date. Center of the activity, and it's an ongoing process. So we're really in the process right now.
Oh, yeah. We have been for years.
Right.
Robert Powell gave a talk. He's an astrologer.
I've lost. I don't have a process.
And the energy that this over a decade.
I don't have a process. Well, okay. You know, the interesting thing is that my Pisces got dissolved. I don't have Pisces here. There's no PI. I can't understand it. It's gone. I had it before. This was swept out to sea. Okay. I'm looking for Neptune returns. Natal position, maybe. Let's see if... No, it won't be. Position or ingress. And yet here there's not one Pisces. It should have everything and there's no PI. Amazing. All right, we'll just let it go. Let it go. The summation of human desire for material happiness has been reached. And this was written 60 years ago. And the peak of that desire has been passed, he says. Thus mankind has achieved and surmounted much, but the rhythm of the ages is strong. So lots of momentum that continues to disturb us with material desire. Also, the heyday of Mars upon the astral plane, Mars and Scorpio, ended in 1945 or 1946. So the greatest emotional violence and those Martian warlike compulsions that would take everybody into the swing of things has also passed.
There's also been a lot of artificial effort to maintain that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to keep it. To keep it. Yeah.
But okay. Like the peak has passed of the material desire. On the contrary, it seems like.
I know, but this is his perspective. That's all we're doing. We're just saying. This is the master's perspective on this. He's probably looking at how it really looks from the inner planes and compare, you know, and probably there was a whole lot of this veil that we didn't even see, and he saw that, and he sees how it is now, and that was in 1940s that he's writing. Now, whether it's been reignited, okay, perhaps.
Well, you know, Michael Moore pointed out in that memo from Citibank about this plutonomy.
Plutonomy.
The motivation for the plutonomy of the 1% who holds most of the wealth is fear, not desire. They're being told and feel like we got to hold on to these possessions and gain more because the other 99% might become restless.
And the presence, yes.
Yeah. So really, I think the desire is switched over to fear and holding now as opposed to desire.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
I think DK also mentions the will to power. The will to power,
right,
which drives these people. It's not greed.
Yeah.
It's the absolute power.
Yeah. Yeah.
Comes
yeah.
With wealth.
And that is very often with the moon changers. They have that particular thing between the will, because if we think about the earlier solar system moon chain, that it was father and the mother, the power and the matter. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, something. I just lost my Pisces. I can't believe it. It's like one has to put on a completely new program. It's just Pisces doesn't exist anymore. Let's try that. No. I know. I mean, you know, it's sad when it happens, but Pisces just slipped away again.
What is this pre-Atlantean?
I you know, here's Libra. This I've got two Libras. And no Pisces.
Two Libras.
Something is wrong. Let's try that. Well, actually, these are return sections. It shouldn't be a return at all. Of course, I don't expect you to advance and ingress, and this is ingress. It's gone. Pisces is gone.
I just call that in general. The technical term for things like this is in general called Patness.
Yes. I think it means start the computer again and hope. All right. These three qualities have to be grasped and discounted by. These three qualities have to be grasped and discounted by the aspirant as he seeks to serve from mental levels. What are the three qualities?
Fear,
expectancy, and climaxing desire. Okay. In the place of fear, he must substitute that peace which is the prerogative of those who live always in the light of the eternal. You know, may the holy ones as people we aspire to become. You know, there's a peace that passeth understanding and abides in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. The peace that passeth understanding. In place of fear, he must substitute the peace which is the prerogative of those who live always in the light of the eternal, in the place of questioning expectancy, which is also influenced by fear, he must substitute that placid yet active assurance of the ultimate objective, which comes from a vision of the plan and his contact with other disciples and later with the Master. So, assurance of what must be. Okay. Right. Desire for material possession must be superseded by aspiration for those possessions which are the joy of the soul.
Yes.
Wisdom, love, and power to serve. It's a bit like David Courtney. He said, what is real wealth? He said, what is wealth? And he mentioned such things as these internal states and happiness and all that. Peace, assurance, and right aspiration. And you know, it's very interesting here about the aspiration is mentioned in a Taurian position. Taurus usually desires many of these other things, but it has the high aspiration for wisdom, light, love, and the power to serve through the nuclear world service, etc. These three words, peace, assurance, and right aspiration. That's good. When understood and experienced in the life of every day will bring about that right condition of the waters. There's your formula. The right condition of the waters for the magical work will be established through the establishment of peace, assurance, and aspiration. So he's basically saying, if you want to live in, if you want to have the right condition of the waters, he's saying in a way, live in the eternal. See what the plan must bring and believe it. And aspire towards true non-material values.
There's something very 70s about that.
I wasn't in the 70s. I can't remember. I took that decade off.
I'm just saying that the flower child, the peace, and the abandonment of material goals for back to the land or simple living and the surge of spiritual aspiration that was really apparent back in those days, which was then, for whatever reason, eclipsed by the decade of greed of the 80s.
Is that corrupted?
Well, there were a lot of astrological things that happened. Capricorn got involved in a negative sense in the 80s.
I just want to recall for 2 years benefit what was Rock said last night about this is the issue of joy of the soul. He was talking about money will follow service.
We have to talk more.
Yes, yeah, no, this is what he said. But that's a good point. Money will follow service. Power to serve. Money will follow service. I think that's the new stock.
But like Tuya brought up, there would be a website, and there are established projects, and established form. An established form that is skeletal and empty without the money, that the service has been put forth. The money will arrive when that whole skeletal form is in fact intact and divinely vibrating.
Yeah. And people will see these
people will see it, it'll be filled out. We just need to start doing it and do all the incubating steps, the little things.
So good.
Everyone's doing the little things.
It sounds like we're off and running here.
I think all the people who have the right spiritual intent, never mind the ego gets in and all the games and traps for all of us, I believe that in the next year, that the spiritual people, the financial money will be brought to them to help them. In the meantime, they're just being knocked up against the wall for the last remnants to be ripped away and prepare them for what's needed from them. Like everything else in the future, whether you're ready or not, you'll be given what you need to go forward.
Well, let's hold the positive intent. I do want to say, however, when we speak of peace, there are superficial impressions of peace. How many are truly living in the eternal? That's a high state of consciousness. That's a Buddhic state of consciousness. Yeah. So you can ask yourself, how in your own life, there is a peace that passeth understanding. It abides in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. So, do you have that?
No.
Or is there still a bit of work required? Do you know truly what the plan will bring? And are you assured in detail? Is your knowledge of the plan such that you can live with the kind of assurance discussed here? See, I'm saying that there are well-meaning and superficial interpretations of these words, and then there are deeper kinds of understandings that are expected of us. So let us apply ourselves to these words if we want to become the kind of magician that this book is trying to create. These three words, when understood and experienced in the life of every day, will bring about that right condition of the waters which will ensure the survival of every thought form rightly engendered in meditation by the man functioning as a soul. Nothing could be clearer than what is being presented here as to how to keep your thought forms from drowning, from capsizing. If we want to be real, if we really want to help the world, we're supposed to be in this kind of emotional condition. For how many of us is it so? Peace, assurance, and right aspiration is a philosophical view of life, which is, let's just say, what's involved here is overcoming the usual sense of time. And this is, what's happening here is seeing what is happening behind the scenes. And and is intended to happen. Okay, seeing what's happening behind the scenes, and what will work out, and right aspiration. Well, okay, here's the question: how much do you really want wisdom in your life? How much do you really love? And how much do you really serve? See, in other words, we can take these things from a superficial angle, or we can really put ourselves over the grill and ask, have we achieved these things? We want to be effective magicians? Okay. Then this is what we have to apply ourselves to. All right, now let's see about the safety of the one who is creating. This is a very interesting section. Might be said here with emphasis that even if it is a recognized truism, and even if, that people are frequently slain in the occult and therefore the more important sense by their own thought forms. I mean, you can be a walking personality, biologically alive and occultly dead. In other words, everything in you that really lives is gone. And your own thought forms can do that. You know, as my old teacher used to say, there they are, just waiting to be thrown in the grave. He was looking at brunch on Sunday. he used to kind of, you know, he was just this old guy that had an amazing insight. And he just saw people going through their patterns and their rhythms, their traditional, it's after church now. Here comes brunch in the Women's League at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Where's the mind? You know, no, it's just the fulfillment of the pattern. Waiting for the inevitable end without real aspiration, without really knowing how to go forward. It was depressing in one way, and in another way, an incentive. I decided never to eat brunch on Sunday at the Women's League.
Never eat brunch in the same place on Sunday.
Well, it was, that takes me back 45 years ago. Okay, people are frequently slain by their own thought forms. Thought creation, thought concentration, and meditation is a potently dangerous matter. How do you feel about that? Want to go back study New Age stuff? Well, you know, think about it. You know, well, hey, we're just talking about how to make thoughts and just talking about magic. I just thought I'd accent that a little. Thought creation, thought concentration, and meditation. You're involved with a potently dangerous matter. You're meditating now. Okay? This must never be forgotten. Yes. There are forms of thought unencumbered by much desire matter which, failing to pass downward, poison the man on mental levels. This they do in two ways: by growing so potent on the mental plane that the man falls a victim to the thing he has created. This is the idée fixe of the psychiatrist. Sounds of recent interest. The obsession which drives to lunacy, the one-pointed line of thought which eventually terrorizes its creator. These are thoughts on which no constructive action is taken. They're just built in built and built and brooded upon. Okay, so much building, much brooding, no constructive outlet. No constructive outlet, except a final outlet. B.K. warns 2, 4, and 6 types against this. He says they brood for a long time on something until it breaks loose either as a beautiful artistic creation or as some humanitarian effort or as some form of madness in the world, some violent outburst, as we have recently seen. All right. Yes, okay. How else? What else? Poisoning in two ways. Point two, by multiplying so fast that the mental aura of the man becomes like unto a thick and dense cloud through which the light of the soul must fail to penetrate, and through which the love of human beings, the lovely and beautiful and comforting activities of nature and of life in the three worlds equally fail to pierce. Could this be depressing? Well, you know, you've seen people, they walk around with a cloud around them. What have they been pondering? What have they been thinking? Pretty soon you can't reach them, and no amount of encouragement or vision of the beauty of life or goodness can make the slightest impression, because they have absolutely insulated themselves through their overabundant creations. Nothing can get through. You oftentimes hear, nothing can get through to him. You hear that. And it's usually because of this cloud. Yeah. And then people become suicidal. The man is smothered, is suffocated by his own thought forms, and succumbs to the miasma which he himself has engendered. So, thought form making and meditation is potently dangerous. Not just dangerous, potently dangerous. Or again, there are lines of thought which draw forth from the emotional body a reaction of a poisonous nature. A certain line of thought is followed by a human being in relation to his brethren. It breathes hatred, jealousy, and envy, and works through into manifestation in such a manner that it produces those physical plane activities which cause the death of the Creator. So be careful what you think and ponder upon, because even if you don't actually talk to someone, you can evoke from them a counter response to your own thoughts. This may be literal, as in the case of murder, which in many cases is the result of crystallized intent on the part of the Creator, or it may result in disease. Well, murder or disease, you take your pick.
You know, this is a conflict of understanding here for me, because in a situation like that, sometimes it's very good for the person to talk about those thoughts, because another person can help them to solve them or put them in perspective.
Yep.
or
sure.
Decide about it. On the other hand, we were studying the other day that when we have bad thoughts, it's better not to speak about them, because that gives them some strength.
Sure, but that's a control release. You go to a therapist, you go to a friend, you know, you... But these are people who are, you know, the kind of sociopathic, or they cut themselves off, and they don't exchange, because when you start to exchange with somebody, something modifying can happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to have a good friend, to have a good therapist, you know, but people, you know, just continue to brood to no good intent, and then the environment speaks. And even the environment speaking is at least breaking the condition. You know, it's like a law against malcreation. So there will be a destructive intent coming forth from the environment, which at least will break up the negativity.
Right. Perhaps the early church, the Roman Catholic Church, instituted confession just to refuse this concept, which was, I think, unique in humanity at that time, and from the other cultures, there were other things.
There is great power in confession.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sat for 10 days in a meditation room with, you know, in silence for 10 days, meditating 10 hours a day, and in that break, the teacher said, come for those of you, and he's an Eastern teacher.
Yeah.
Come, some of you,
for a what is called a Christian confession, because it can release that from the
holding. Good for the soul. Good for the soul. Of course, it's good for politics too. Unfortunately, it became used. You know what I mean? The confession booth was used to gain information, power, and control. But we know what the original purpose was.
On a global level, this is quite powerful. Because
it's like
what I think the same word wrote this amazing piece from his guy John after 9/11, where people were asking why this happened to us, America. And that piece is profound, because he said that there was a maelstrom of negativity that had been generated around the planet. And the soul of America agreed to be the release valve for that negativity and to take it on as a sacrifice. So it's the same idea of releasing. Something in the environment has to be.
You know, there is a great difference in that when there is a purpose and an intention, decision, and the will to change that what was in the past. And what she was saying, Tara, is that when people when we just talk about things without no intention, trying to solve it or change it, we just repeat and want to have attention from the other people to just listen our story over and over again. That will change when we have the convention.
Confession
is like the last word of that old pattern.
I think what becomes to me as we're talking is this idea of talking and bringing consciousness, and it's bringing light into the pattern so it can be broken or dispelled.
Okay.
Well, you know, our country did a lot of evil things because many of our leaders were consumed with the need to control and power and greed, financially, and
doesn't happen for no reason.
And because of that, though, now it seems to me, I mean, like we invaded Central America 19 times, for God's sake, some of the last century. And now I feel that mankind is being forced to confess. A confession energy to release this is being forced for the good of our country's soul.
Well, he calls for the great day of forgiveness. I don't think it's really happened, but in a way you confess to yourself that all are responsible, and we leave all things behind us. International, was it yearly or once? A day of global forgiveness. Now look, we got to keep moving forward, okay? Did you have a point?
Well, the South African Council for Truth and Reconciliation, or whatever it was a good example of this large scale opportunity for forgiveness and confession.
It was run by two, really, if you look at Mandela and Tutu, you got two, a first rate and a second rate disciple there, really managing that whole transition. Pure thought, right motive, and loving desire are the true correctives of disease. Okay. And where the desire for these, which does animate many, is raised to constructive thinking, there will be the gradual elimination of disease. As yet, though many desire, few think. Well, that's the... And that really touches on our subject, precisely. Our subject is all about clear, pure, constructive thought, and how to make that thought effective. That's what it's about. Let it never be forgotten that the great ones do not look for those who only desire and aspire. They look for those who blend with their desire the determination to learn to use their mental bodies and become creators, and who will work constructively towards these ends. Thus, it will be seen why in all systems of true occult training the emphasis is laid on right thinking, loving desire, pure, clean living. That covers all the three lunar vehicles. We're talking about the condition of the waters, and we're talking about the safety of the one who thus creates. Obviously, this sets up a condition of safety, but he's going to get into some technicalities about how to be safe. Only thus can the creative work be carried forward with safety, and thus, only thus, can the thought form pass down into objectivity and be a constructive agent on the plane of human existence. Okay, here he doesn't cover it, because he covered it in white, in cosmic fire. He said, you align with the love petals. There's a particular love petal. That stream of energy flows through the throat center, creates a stream of energy around the magician, which wards off the predations of these particular Agni Suryans who otherwise would attack. And elsewhere he tells us about how the magician can drown. So if you put these two things together, here he's taking the more moral route, how you can protect yourself through loving desire. But otherwise he also takes the specific throat center mantric route, where knowledge is involved in the protective process. Okay, steady contemplation. Okay, the condition of the waters, the safety of the one who thus creates, and steady contemplation, this is related to the eye. The condition of the waters is related to the heart, the safety of the one who thus creates is related to the throat, and steady contemplation to the eye. You will note here that the word meditation is not used. The thought is a different one. The meditation process involving the use of thought and mental building of the form so that it can be completed and rounded out and aligned with the thought form of the disciples, group of co-disciples, and therefore with the plan, has been completed. And to the best of man's ability. In other words, man, let's just say, man has meditated. Man has meditated. Now something else is needed. Now he must, with steadiness, and that is the word when you apply it to contemplation, now he must with steadiness contemplate that which he has created. In other words, create, and now keep your eye on it. And with equal steadiness, inspire it with the needed light so that it can fulfill its function. And we read yesterday how the solar angel looks at its lunar vehicle steadily and thus inspires and transmutes it. Transmutation arises through the gaze. In this case, we're talking about vitalization arising through the gaze. You're building, and now you're holding it in your mind's eye, and you're merging with it, vitalizing it, and making it sufficiently vital to take up its role on the astral plane. We're still on the mental plane here. These are mental rules, but he's looked ahead to the transition from the mental plane to the astral plane. So he's now talking about both planes. He ceases to reason, to think, to formulate, and to build in mental matter. He simply pours his life steadily into the form and sends it forth to carry out his will. So before it is sent forth, and we did this in this morning's meditation, it has to be properly vitalized. And you know, we could even put together Roberto Saggioli's six acts of will, you know, the act of will in six stages, and we could find the way it works here as well. So we're not just, you know, we're done, you know, as we were saying before, Bill, I mean, we got it to a point, we're going to have to keep thinking and thinking about it. Now we really animate it, and we animate it with our inner gaze. How many have tried to do this in your life? Now, you know, sometimes I see an artist who has created something beautiful, and then they just walk around and look at it. It's done, and they just keep looking at it. Sometimes I write a letter to someone, often, and instead of rewrite, I just read it, and I read it again, and I read it again. And I realize that something's happening with that. It's not just a question of rearranging it so it's better. I'm not reading it like an editor. I'm reading it like one who wants to empower the letter.
Yeah.
I do that all the time.
Do you? Okay.
Is that bad? Not bad?
No, if what you're saying is good, it's great.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question regarding the creative process. Actually, the artistic process. What's the occult rationale or explanation for the attitude of, some artists not to talk about their work before a certain stage?
Okay, I think that is taken up by occultism, basically saying if you are brooding on a particular thought form, don't take energy away from it while it's in formulation. Keep it internal, do your best with it, and release it for the world, because you may just dissipate the energy you need to complete it.
So during a brooding stage,
Yes. However, afterwards, you know, you can talk about it all you want, and other people probably talk more.
The key is many artists don't talk about it afterwards ever.
Okay.
In the respect to the viewer, and let them derive cleanly what they are intuiting without anything that the creator's illusion of intent to the other person. Artist meant for the beholder, really. That's why
yes, and they oftentimes say that the worst interpreter of a piece of art is its creator. You know, and just like, you know, don't let the composer conduct it.
Right. Well, there's another point, too, about holding the
bias.
You get biases from the observers who are listening to you talk about it, and that biases your piece of art.
Sure. Okay. All right. So, but we're getting to that point where we're learning how to look at what we've created. It's on the mental plane right now, and it's not that arranging and rearranging stage, although that, you know, in life that may follow. You look at something and you see something, but let's just say you're really satisfied with it. Now the gaze empowers. And when you gaze, you don't just look objectively. It's not just like, you know, you are investing yourself in what you are seeing. In contemplation, you invest your identity in that which you have created, and it becomes you, and you become it. In other words, without Venus to merge the subject and object, you're not really contemplating. In contemplation, subject and object are merged. Hence, as Robert was saying the other day, samadhi, contemplation. The dualism is overcome. Okay. Just as long as he can contemplate and hold steady, so will his creation fulfill its intention and act as his agent. Now, it almost sounds like before and after. It sounds a little bit here that you empower it through long and effective contemplation before, and once it is released, then what? You know, are you, do you also bring it to mind and continue to empower it out there in the world? I think it is a practical way of working before we know entirely what we're doing. Maybe once you're just a crackerjack magician, you know everything perfectly, you send it out and that's it. But, you know, before that's done, I'm sure you're revisiting the form that has been released and augmenting it. Don't we do that all the time? You got to keep your eye on your business, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that the exact phrase? He keeps his eye upon it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he keeps his eye upon it. But what I'm saying is that even once it's released.
Yeah, once it's released.
Yeah. Just as long as he can contemplate and hold steady, so will his creation fulfill the intention and act as an agent. So we're saying, even once released, the eye can be turned to that which is released and augment its vitality.
Well, earlier on, didn't we see that as soon as he takes his eye off, it dissipates?
Or even wherever it comes in, but that's the idea, yes. When you take your eye off your creation, of course, you know, some people are dead and they're no longer looking at their creations.
How do we know?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that other people are now animating their creations with their eyes. So once the thought form achieves a degree of viability and appeal to others, then their own love of it keeps it animated. And the creator then can say, okay, you know, some creators just say, look, enough has been said. Everybody's saying everything. I say nothing. But other people are keeping it alive through their own attention. Just so long as he can focus his attention on the ideal for which he created his thought form and can link the form and the ideal together in one steady vision. And I want to say again, both before and after. Because, you know, sometimes We're not exactly sure whether he's talking about the process itself or after the process has completed. Just so long it will serve his purpose and express his ideal. Herein lies the secret of all successful cooperation with the plan. You know, let's be realistic. We do something in the world and we keep on improving it, don't we? How do we improve it? You know,
aligning
with the ideal. And then, you know, we keep that link between the ideal and the act, and we are the intermediary. So let's just say we are the intermediary between the ideal and the embodiment. And we keep, I'm sure there are many people who are involved in that right now. You've done something in the world, it's out there, it's part of an ideal. So but if you ever forget what the ideal is, then what's out there can really degenerate.
Right.
And we see that all the time. In other words, let's just say, why did Tsongkhapa come back and reform Buddhism? Or anything like that. Because people lost sight of the original animating impulse. Is there anything in your life that you are now nurturing, which you are, in relation to which you are in danger of losing sight of the original intent? I ask myself.
I was thinking they got to the church, and not the churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's happened all around us, but now I'm asking us about ourselves. Have we sent anything forth, and is it degenerating because we've lost the link with the original intention? Okay. Ideal, plan, execution. We will now study for a while the words heart, throat, and eye, for they have a peculiar significance. These three form the apparatus to be employed by all disciples during the world cycle which is so rapidly coming. Okay. That there is not yet a very large body of disciples in incarnation at this time, and that the apparatus with many who are functioning on the level of discipleship is but in embryo, is profoundly true. Okay, we're a small number and we're ill-equipped. Okay. However, we're the bad news bearers, we'll win. It should be remembered, however, that the world cycle has only just been inaugurated and will cover a vast period of time. What do you think he means? Well, I don't know. Is that vast? Maybe. Is the AA vast enough? There are only about 400 accepted disciples in the world at this time. Well, maybe it's up 10 by now. Yeah, it's old, I mean.
Well, he said by the end of, you know, the days better, but that, you know, thousands of people would have taken the first initiation by such.
Well, when the Christ appears, it will be the indication that humanity has taken the first initiation. That's one thing.
Wow.
When the Christ appears.
But later books, I mean, these are early books. Later books teach that by now thousands more have taken the first degree.
Even I'm trying to remember whether the word millions are involved. I'm trying to remember that. Or at least disciples. No, an accepted, I don't think so. An accepted disciple need not have taken the second initiation, but need be inside of it. All right. So anyway, this is written in the early 30s.
Most of these are probably dead.
Yes, and my gosh, it's tough. No replacements have come forth. Whoa, let's meditate on that. All right. That is, men and women who really know they are disciples and know what their work is and are doing it. That's one of the definitions here of an accepted disciple. There are nevertheless many hundreds out of the present generation of young people who stand on the verge of acceptance and thousands upon the probationary path. So we just have to ask, I'm sure you know, this has changed much. Yes? But how much? You know, we don't know. They know the numbers, and so they know the forces that they can use. In all through the esoteric groups, there should be forming a group in which an intellectual understanding of this mechanism of heart, throat, and eye will be found. It should be constituted of those who are submitting themselves to a discipline and a training which will make its use a demonstrated fact in nature to them. I would call attention to these words and request their careful study. Make its use, or should we say their use, a demonstrated fact. Heart, throat, and eye. No, the mechanism of heart, throat, and eye. So we have to learn to use the mechanism of heart, throat, and eye. Obviously, we, all of us, have still much to learn about how to do this. But we should be forming a group, a nucleus, in a way in which intellectual understanding will be there. And that's what we're trying to do in this kind of class. A mechanism in the natural body comes into use in two ways. First, its use is involuntary, and there is no comprehension of how or why or when the apparatus is used. It just happens. You find yourself using it. So it just springs up. And you say, oh, I can do this. And I don't know what I'm doing or why I'm doing it or what it means. I thought everybody saw those things. Whatever. Okay. An animal employs a mechanism analogous in many respects to that employed by man. He sees and hears and functions organically along similar lines to the human, but lacks the mental understanding and the linking of cause and effect. This is one of the major things, and it's such a mercury thing, which are characteristic of the higher kingdom of nature. Linking cause and effect in some conscious manner is missing. Although you often see animals, in a way, unconsciously linking cause and effect. In other words, that's animal learning. A similar state of affairs exists in the early stages of the path of discipleship and the final stages of the probationary path. Let's see if we can discriminate these. The disciple becomes aware of capacities and powers which are not yet, as yet, intelligently under his control. He experiences flashes of insight and of knowledge which seem unaccountable and of no immediate value. He contacts vibrations and phenomena of other realms but remains unaware of the process whereby he has done so, and is incompetent either to renew or recall the experience, hence the need for the science of meditation and of recall. Within his etheric body, he senses active forces. Sometimes he can localize them. And in any case, he admits theoretically that there is awakening into conscious activity, a sevenfold structure which is symbolic in form and potent when employed. His chakra system, presumably. He cannot as yet control it, and he's quite incapable of calling it into intelligent cooperation with his purposes and ideas, no matter how hard he tries. All right, so what is this? A picture of incapacity. Can we relate to this? Something's happening, don't know what, can't make it happen again. All that he can do is to register such phenomena and keep a record of those experiences, hence the spiritual diary. Bearing always in mind that in the early stages of his unfoldment, only the coarsest and most material of the vibrations will be registered on his brain consciousness. So he may think it's new and wonderful, but really compared to what's happening later, it's rather outer. He simply has to wait and to bring his mind to bear upon the purifying of his vehicles and the elimination of all he recognizes as liable to distort his vision. So basically what he's doing, he is ridding himself of Maya and glamour. This period may be as long or short according to the this period may be long or short according as the aspirant is entering upon into the subjective consciousness for the first time, or is taking up the thread of an older or partially achieved undertaking. DK pointed to some disciples who had been accepted disciples for five lives already. Or many lives in some cases. For many lives you've been an accepted disciple. To another one he says, this is your first life, technically speaking, in which you have stepped upon the path of accepted discipleship. I think he said that to a person who was getting ready to take the second initiation. Of course, not having been an accepted disciple doesn't mean he wasn't progressing, because we're told that accept the discipleship as the special relationship between the master and the disciple based upon a karmic past. I would like here to make perfectly clear to all true and earnest aspirants that in the training to be given during the next few decades, the unfoldment of astral vision and hearing will be entirely ruled out, or if it exists, will eventually have to be overcome. Wow. What does he mean by a few decades? The true disciple has endeavored to center himself on the mental plane with the object in view of transferring his consciousness higher still into wider and inclusive awareness of soul. That's the true disciple. Okay, let's see. His aim is to include the higher, and there is no need for him at this stage to regain the astral facility, which was the possession, as you well know, of the little evolved races of the earth and of many of the higher animals. No need to regain. Do you agree with that? Later on, when adeptship has been reached, he can function on the astral plane should he so choose. That's not even the third degree. I want to ask there, what about the third degree? When all of the, well, that's, no. Third degree, then we say third degree for higher psychism. Maybe reclaiming the lower psychism is not needed. But it should be remembered that the master works with the soul aspect of humanity and of all forms and does not work with their astral bodies. This has often been forgotten by teachers both in the East and the West. In working with the souls and true technique of evolution, the true technique of evolution is carried forward, where it is the soul within the forms in every kingdom in nature which is responsible for the developing of developing work of and within the form. May I say therefore to students that their main objective is to become aware of the soul, to cultivate soul consciousness, and to learn to live and work as souls. Do we feel that is our main objective? Okay. Until such time as their use of their apparatus becomes voluntary, they would be well advised to train their minds, study the laws governing manifestation, and learn to include all that which we now cover by the higher, by the word higher. A misnomer, but it must suffice. Well, let's see. We, you know, obviously we're going to run out of time here.
That's 45 minutes.
Yeah, we do. The light in the head is here discussed. You know, this is a, there's a, another 10 pages here or more. I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave this, you know, because it really, we could get much involved in it, but I think something can be accomplished by just closing off at least what Cosmic Fire says about the sixth rule. By the way, we have to learn how to discriminate between the following. Look at this.
Yeah.
The soul's vibration, the vibration of the group of disciples with whom we may be associated, and the vibration of the master. Think of the difference between the master and the soul, and discriminating these vibrations. We have to do this. They are easy to confuse at first, we are told. The disciple soon finds out that the masters are not easily accessible. This should be written on the refrigerator also, with other things. They are busy men, ill able to spare even a few moments in which to communicate with the disciple, and only in emergencies, in the case of the beginner on the path of discipleship, do these masters expend the necessary energy with which to get on rapport. When old and tired disciples, with old and tried disciples, the contact are more frequent, being more easily achieved and bearing more rapid results. It should be remembered, however, that the newer the disciple, the more he demands attention and considers he should have it. I think, you know, choice punchlines from DK. We can get it all together. The older, more experienced servers seek to fulfill their obligations and carry forward their work with as little contact with the masters as possible. They seek to save the master's time and frequently consider an interview with the master as demonstrating failure on their part and producing, therefore, regret that they have had to take the Master's precious time and force him to use his energy in order to safeguard the work from error and the disciple, perhaps, from harm. Okay, I think it's good. Oh, and then we get into the six stages of discipleship, which we're not doing now. So we can go then, and we'll go to the final rule, which is, the devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. They are driven forth and lose their master. Now, there's going to be a lot of stuff here on the third eye and the pineal gland and so forth, but we did kind of take that up and discuss it to a degree. Now we're back to cosmic fire. Okay. Okay, who would like to read this? Don't read the red stuff, just read the black stuff.
The egoic energy transmitted via the physical brain. It's directed now to the work of sending forth the form, so that it may clothe itself in astral matter. The eye of the thinker opens, and the pulsing vitality streams forth.
Very interesting.
The pulsing vitality streams forth.
From the eye, yeah.
Warded up, he said here, for till the eye is functioning, it is not possible for men to comprehend the nature of the energy which they will then wield or direct.
So, this is very interesting, right? From the third eye, the power of repulsing the thought form emanates. In other words, that's part of driving it forth. Thought form forth. Now, this eye of Shiva has a strong first-rate component to it. And we all know that the energy which scatters and disperses and drives is the first ray. So when you are dissociating something from yourself, even when you're sending forth a projectile, it's first ray. And when you are repulsing or scattering something, it's first ray. So, okay. All right.
Five rules for the astral plane. Before we take up the consideration of the second set of rules for magic, I would like to make a few remarks anent the eye of the magician, to which reference has been earlier made. One of the fundamental rules back of all magical processes is that no man is a magician or a worker in light magic until the third eye is open or in process of opening. For it is by means of that eye that the thought form is energized, directed and controlled, and the lesser builders or forces are swept into any particular line of activity. Among the coming discoveries and among the next revelations of materialistic science will be one which will concern itself with the force-directing faculty of the human eye, alone or collectively, and this will indicate one of the first stages towards the rediscovery of the third eye, or the eye of Shiva. Shiva is, as we know, one of the names for the first great logoic aspect, and under that name is hidden much of esoteric moment.
Okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm beginning to think, I think we have, okay, we have read much of this. So we have read much of this. The third eye exists in etheric matter. It is an etheric center of force in the area of the pineal gland, being made of substance of the ethers, whereas the pineal gland is formed of matter of the three lower subplanes. And this is important. The pineal gland, however, the latter, has to be functioning more or less before the eye of Shiva becomes in any degree active. Okay. Well, you know what? We've done enough of this. I think, basically, he finished very quickly with rule number six. Let's see what he says over here. This is, a mere 10 pages. Let's get into this section of it. Or unless he's just transposed it over from the... It looks like he's done that. He's done the same. He's transposed it over. Right. He has. My gosh, we may have to force ourselves to get into a discussion. Okay, and then we talked about the formation of the third eye. Did we read this, however?
No.
Maybe not.
You told us a few things about it, I think, in your comments.
Okay,
I'm sure we read it.
No.
We could.
It's not bad, the eye of Shiva. Well, we did, yeah. We spent quite a bit of time on this, and I just suggest you're going to get...
Because we did the compilation.
You're going to get the compilation. And, yeah, we have done this. Now, I think we did talk a little bit about, does anybody remember how the third eye gets going? What happens? The third eye is formed, the ego on its own plane. Yeah, that's right. We did this somewhat. The head center itself, the core, yeah, we did this. The major head center on top of the head, and one other, the reflex action of the pineal gland itself. All right, I think then, let's have a reread of the six rules. And then we'll make whatever closing comments we have about these rules and what we may have learned over the whole 5 days, and what we feel inclined to do as a result of assimilating them more completely.
Michael, can I just say, before lunch or when we break for lunch, I just wanted to extend an invitation tonight at 5 or 6 o'clock when class is over to anyone who wants to join us at my home. I'm serving pizza. I know you had it last night, but I'm serving pizza, and we're going to show a movie for 90 minutes called The Most Dangerous Man in the World. Here's directions, but for anybody who's going to join me, I won't be coming back after lunch. I need to know what kind of pizza you like.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I think, Diane, we're going to do that after we take our break.
Yeah.
In other words,
I just want them to go out of the room and miss somebody.
Sure, because I don't want to break this right now, but as soon as we finish with our morning roundup, then if you're planning to come to Diane tonight, then please... Right. Okay. So let's review this. The solar angel collects himself, scatters not his force, but in meditation deep communicates with his reflection. That's right. As a matter of fact, I think that I can show you this is the sequence that we are given. So we'll go from here. After reading these, we'll go right to the summary of them. When the shadow hath responded, in meditation deep the word proceedeth. The lower light, remember what that is? This is of the physical, etheric, and the light of the soul in the personality, is thrown upward. The greater light illuminates the three, and the work of the four proceedeth.
The four
are the soul above, and the three lower lights, and the three lower vehicles. The three lower vehicles are your mind, emotions, and body, but the three lower lights are the light of your dense physical, your vital, and the light of the soul within your mechanism, which maybe could be called the light of the mind, in a way. The energy circulates. The energy... that is being generated by the soul and by the meditator on the physical plane. The point of light, which is your thought form, the product of the labors of the four, you, the threefold personality, and the soul, waxeth and groweth. The myriads of deva builders gather around its glowing warmth till they cover it, its light receding, its fire grows dim, and then the second sound is going to go forth, which is the deliberate Om, augmenting the higher note of the soul. Find the note of the soul and augment it with the Om. Sound, light, vibration, and the form blend and merge. Now we're talking about the building of the form, and thus the work is one. It proceedeth under the law, and naught can hinder now the work, from going forward. So a point of momentum has been passed on the mental plane whereby your own is no longer so needed to enrich the thought form and make sure that all the little builders come into the proper place under your visualization. A sufficient point has been reached, now it's going to go forward. The man breathes deeply, so he's taking that inhalation, and in a state of contemplation, he's consulting with the inner worlds, consulting with the ego, and is augmenting the power of the thought form through the steady gaze. And he drives the thought form from him on the expulsive breath. Three things engage the solar angel before the sheath created passes downward. So now we're preparing for its, he's detached itself from himself, but now there's going to be a passing down into the astral waters, the condition of the waters. What were the three things that saw to the condition of the waters? So one of them was assurance. Peace, assurance, and...
Right aspiration.
Yeah, right aspiration. And we know the deeper meanings of those things, right? So, in other words, we have to really see to our psychology before the astral nature is sufficiently calm to receive the sending thought form. The safety of the one who thus creates, what are some methods of producing safety?
Pure thought?
Right
mode?
Yes, love, yes. Desire? Yes, yes. As described in the white magic, and then the heart mantram passing through the throat and surrounding the meditative magician, repulsing the Agni Suryans, and steady contemplation. And this is the augmenting eye. The eye, the inner eye, before we have the third eye operating, can we use the imagination? I think so. In other words, if you want to make a good thought form which is useful in the world, and you're not quite sure whether you have your third eye in complete shape, you can use your mind's eye, which eventually gives way to the third eye. Anywhere between the first and third initiation, the third eye is developing. By the time you've taken the third initiation, the third eye is of sufficient coherence and power to do some work here, without just using the normal imagination. Thus are the heart, the throat, and the eye allied for triple service. The devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. Now, this is sort of the grip which the four lower elementals have upon your process. They are no longer controlling the show because they are driven forth. Until you take the fourth initiation, they are not banished, because you need them. You can't live otherwise. But they are gripped, their hold is loosened, they are no longer, their master is no longer the personality elemental per se. He explains this. The soul, the magician, the creator, the soul incarnation is now their master. Is there a difference between the magician or soul in incarnation and the personality? Is there a difference between the disciple and the personality? So you realize yourself as an extension of the higher ego, and it is, and you have discriminated yourself from the personality. You are now the master of the Vedic forces. You have the method of doing this, at least on the mental plane at first. Now, the lower four, there's another way of looking at the lower four. You're on the lower mental plane, aren't you? Who could the lower four be? The devas of the lower four sub-planes of the mental plane. The personality is no longer in charge. You, the creator, in line with your soul and soul note, are now in charge. And you have adequate means of being in charge because they have been conferred to you.
If you're focused on the fourth or at the mental unit, mm-hmm. and you're able to hold your concentration there...
But the other devas are involved in the building of the form, probably, too. Are they not? Other
yes.
devas are involved in the
yes.
building of the form.
But that means you're in control of those four levels.
Yes. Yes. You are increasing. And where is the personality elemental?
Fourth.
Fourth. Same place, isn't it? So there's all there's a point of conflict or of between you and the personality inclinations. If your personality elemental wants to control the devas of these four, what are these four devas going to be inclined to do? Four types of devas. What will they build? They will build a form that suits the personality. But now, who's in charge? You're the master. You are the magician in line with your soul, empowered by your soul, in the light of your soul, and now you control the process on the mental plane. Okay, so over here in number three, DK gives us his own roundup of it. The solar angel begins the work of initiating the personality. Now, it's kind of interesting, but by the creative process, they are initiated. He withdraws his forces from soul enterprises in the spiritual kingdom and centers his attention on the work to be done. Do you feel ever soul compelled, as if your soul has centered its attention on the work to be done within you? Do you feel there's another creator at work and you're under pressure?
Yes.
You know, when the Vulcan stage of your life comes into emerges into reality, the pressure is on. If you don't feel soul pressure, you may become what Master Moria calls light-minded. He warns us all against light-mindedness. It's a trivial application of mental powers, where under the soul has you in a grip, and now you feel there's an inner must-do. Must do as the stern commander, said my teacher. Okay. He enters into meditation deep. Who's he? That's the soul. Magnetic rapport with the instrument in the three worlds is instituted. Under what planet will this take place, or planets? The minute you hear the word magnetic rapport, Venus. Magnetic rapport. And of course, Mercury is involved too. DK often talks about the Venus-Mercury mind. The instrument man responds. Come in, Tony. The instrument man responds and also enters into meditation. Now, look, if we feel like being a white magician, we have been evoked. Or an invocation from the solar angel has come to us and we have responded. So, you know, why are we suddenly wanting to do this? Especially white magic. There can be distortions after it happens, but basically, a voice has said to us, it is time to create. So, the instrument man responds, and also enters into meditation. Presumably, we are there now. We are in synchronous meditation with our soul who is meditating now, trying to get some good pattern working out through us. And we meditate to make sure what that pattern is, and we make the plans of how to carry it out. Many of us are engaged in this right now. We've been evoked. We have responded. We're being fed with soul intention, and we're planning, and we're doing. That's where we are now. The work proceeds in ordered stages and with cyclic activity. As the meditation continues, cyclic impulses from the soul, cyclic receptions from us, refinement of the form, refinement of what we're trying to do, and more skill in action all the time. The light of the soul is thrown downwards. The light of the vital body and the physical form is synchronized with that in the head. Because basically when soul light penetrates to the ethers of the head and the pineal gland, you get the light of the head. So he said the three lower lights are dark light, vital light, and the light of the soul in the personality, but that's the light in the head. Okay. The centers swing into activity. Now you're mobilized. The light of the soul and the two other aspects of light are so intense that now all the life in the three world is illumined. What are you? You are illumined. You've gone through the illumination, the enlightenment. Your centers are all lined up. Your three centers in your head are in radiatory contact. Alpha, third aspect. Pituitary, second aspect. Crown, first aspect. And the inner eye around the pineal gland and through the pineal gland is growing. Meanwhile, the eye of the soul is also involved in this. The eye of the soul within the head center, and now the third eye, or eye of Shiva, around the pineal gland and through the pineal gland being invoked by the circulation. All this is happening at the same time. Intense light. Alignment is produced, the work of discipleship and of initiation becomes possible, finally the third degree, and proceeds according to the law of being, which you have just contacted because it's the third degree. Is the process clear? Of course, you know, we've got to review it. But there it is. And maybe in our service, we'll be able to review some of this in a different way. So do you have any thoughts or questions about this? Have we somewhat consolidated the work on the mental plane? Is it somewhat clear in a practical manner?
Well, it's becoming more clear. I don't think it's just totally clear, but I think every time we go over it, I think it would be good if we could go back over our notes and
sure.
just take the salient points out.
Sure. Yeah, agree.
And then
agree,
have that before
agree.
Us to refresh ourselves.
But I guess you feel more confident in how you should create if you decide to create.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why to create in the first place.
Exactly. And do you feel evoked?
Okay.
In other words, do you feel the presence of something that's been operating to call you forth?
Yeah.
Or do you just think, hey, it was my great bright idea, you know? The personality immediately wants to go, my idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It claims ownership. I had this great idea, you know?
Yeah.
Usually it's my wife that has a great idea, but I say, I had this great idea.
The more time passes, the more we see, do I have any ideas?
Yeah. Any that are my own, really.
Yeah.
Just reaching into the rain cloud of noble things, and what resonates with our vehicle that we can deal with and can manifest.
Well, we can really learn how to do that. You know, and as we build the Antikarana, this reaching into the rain cloud of noble things, that's usually on the Buddhic plane. So let us say that we, you know, because at first we, you know, the solar angel decides to create, and we are being invoked and evoked, and we begin work. But later, as our occult sophistication increases, we learn to go directly to the rain cloud of noble things without depending upon the solar angel to start the process going. Because we are becoming a soul-infused personality, and the solar angel is now part of that point of tension around the mental unit from which we can send the Antikarana up. So when we are touching the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad, we're penetrating on our own at this point. However, supported by the presence of as much of the solar angel as we've been able to absorb. So I don't know, every time I go over this, I feel somehow clearer, somehow more capable of, when I'm planning things in the world, to make sure that the waters are correct, that my motive is right, that I can vitalize the form, that I'm in line with the original intent. I try to stay in line with the original intent, even while things are developing out there in the world. I just feel more confident that the whole thing is proceeding under law. That's the point. This whole 5 days with Saturn in Libra has been about the laws of creation. You know, and I want to be sure of them. I want to know them step by step, you know, in sequence, so that I can perform them simultaneously.
The meditation helped a lot too this morning, just to get a very real, you know, sense of how this might proceed.
Sure, we're all, you know what I mean? So I was doing a meditation, I was realizing, oh, this place should be here, etc. But it will be possible for us when we practice to become actually virtuosos at this task, just like any performer.
Practice where we really need to work.
Yeah.
And like you said, you've been practicing for a long time. And
just beginning. Just beginning.
Practicing, you know, haphazardly.
Sure. But that's it. We need a system.
That's
And we need not to treat DK's books as if they're a bunch of great ideas. He has laid out procedures for us. And these procedures, we have to let good old Saturn grab a hold of us and follow these procedures rigorously. Step by step, as if someone was watching us, ourselves, you know, our very self. You know, no license, no latitude, no room, you know, stay right within the procedure. And once it's very, very secure, then you can start to improvise. But it's terrible to start improvising before you know what you're doing. You know, you just don't have the structure built into you. And so I know, you know, so people come into this kind of occultism and say, boy, there's a lot of Saturn in this. And there is, because we want to be safe and proper and aligned with the plan. Does Saturn have anything to do with the divine plan?
No.
Like everything, right? Go up there to the plane of Atma, it's ruled by Saturn, and that's where the divine plan is really taking shape, isn't it? So if we look a little bit tight in our approach to occultism rather than, you know...
New Agey.
You know what I mean? It's okay, because we're trying to build up a real technique. You know, when you're in training to be a surgeon, I'm sure you try to follow the rules before you begin improvising. And it's that way with any real discipline.
Also the painting, you know, before you can become an abstract artist, you have to go through the training and know how to paint.
The form.
The form.
Exactly. And I'm sure a dancer goes through much.
All the same.
Very rigorous. And a pianist has his scales, and so does a violinist. You know, it's also Saturn before Uranus, which is that Uranus-Neptune marvelous feeling simultaneity can take over. You're really well structured. So we're at that point where I would strongly advise approach in a structured manner, especially any rules. If they are the rules for applicants to individual initiation, approach in a structured manner. If it's the rules for disciples and initiates, 14 of them, treat everything as if it's meant to be rigorous before just saying, hey, I know what this is all about. You know, just make sure the structure is built in. And, you know, you may look a little boring to people as you're doing that, but you'll have a firm foundation on which to stand rather than just a lot of New Ageism transplanted into the Bailey work or into any serious work. I'm sure there are many rules in the LC about what to do and what steps to take, and Blavatsky has these as well. This is rigorous stuff.
I just want to comment on something that we've done, I think, here to make, I'm going to say it the wrong way, to make this not boring.
Yes, yes.
boring would be just kind of conceptual. We've done a series of experimentations. The meditation this morning was one. We did another one with the OM before. These experiments with something rigorous like this make it alive. And then that's what makes it vital, as far as I'm concerned. Otherwise, the concepts, while trackable,
What do you do with them?
Yeah.
What do you do with the concepts?
Once we try to apply, then we have something to work with here. Then
sure.
The concepts become purificatory.
That's good. Yeah, we do want to put things into action. Of course, you know, we feel a little inhibited. I do anyway. When I see everything that it takes to put these in action in the right way, but I still want to try in a safe way
right.
to do that. Yeah. And I think we can do that. Now, you know, we all live lives that are under pressure. We got a lot of coming and going. We're moving around a lot, you know. Or if not, we're moving around a lot in our mind. Can we create those islands of stability in which we can practice these things? You know, because, face it, you know, reading DK in this century is like taking a big survey course.
Yeah.
You know, oh, he said this about this about this about this, and where is the practice to institute in our natures what he has given us? That takes so much Saturn. You know, Saturn is your friend, and Saturn reserves the time to do these things. I'm talking to myself, you know. I want to make sure that I have time for the most important, which is this internal structuring act.
Well, you have in the biggest letters of all of morning meditation.
Well, yeah. Did you notice that?
I noticed.
Yeah.
That was good. That was a good reminder, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know how easy it is to kind of roll out of bed and begin the day.
Yeah.
Doing. Yeah. Doobie doobie doo without the bee. Doo-doo-doo-doo as doo-doo. Doobie doo without the bee as doo-doo. That's it. That's it.
I've noticed over the last year, tremendous more kind of a wherewithal and presence in my work because I take, you know, sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes 4 minutes, sometimes 20 minutes, but without that poise in the beginning
of the day, it's like, oh God, I don't know what to do next.
I haven't figured it out. And it all falls apart and I'm late, you know, over time.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does all come together. You see it. My whole day unfolds in what order it should be done.
So take that morning moment, whatever it is, that orienting moment. A lot of activity. I mean, these are very pressurable times. We're compelled to act. But DK says, think fast, act slowly.
Yeah.
And we have also learned about harmlessness this time, too, haven't we? Mm-hmm. That it's perfect poise, a completed point of view, and divine understanding. So it all sounds fairly regulated. And remember how important Regulus is to us disciples. Regulus, this heart of the lion, this place from which we control all the energies of the self. You know, we will learn over the next few hundred years that we've been free and happy about many things without going through the rigorous disciplines that a master must subject himself to. These masters have made themselves do it. And we will learn, too, that we have wasted time in just being too free about some things. That the only real freedom comes from discipline.
There was a teacher in Cyprus where I used to live who said, be disciplined and flow.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose when you're looking at ballet, that's the thing. I mean, if you look at what it takes to give the semblance of the flow and the ease.
It's an incredible discipline.
A kind of rigor, the seventh ray discipline that's involved in this Saturnian thing, the many, many forms. Okay, then, maybe we should just have our mantra. Or is there anything else you would like to say, or... yes.
I would just like to say, Tony and I are going to be leaving at lunchtime.
Okay.
Because we need to get over the mountain before it gets dark. And I just wanted to say goodbye to all of you. We're all together. And it's been just a real joy for me to be with you again.
I'm so glad, Gail, you were able to come. And I'm glad, Tony, you've been able to join us for a few little... tidbits and a number of images. I'm afraid we're all going to get some feedback about what we look like. Yes, everybody.
Want to post them or something?
Yeah, I'm going to put them on
a website. Uh-oh. A website. Whoa. That means others can go there.
What should we call it?
Yes. White magicians in process. Yeah. Anything else that anybody would like to... And we're glad too, Diana Robert, that you were able to come here under the circumstances.
If you come tonight and join me, welcome. If you just come take 1 second and tell me whether you like cheese, vegetarian, or pepperoni and sausage pizza.
And what's the movie about?
It's The Most Dangerous Man in America. It's about, what's his name?
Daniel Ellsberg. Pentagon Papers, remember that?
Which happened 40 years ago, but the documentary is absolutely fantastic. It was at the festival recently. It's phenomenal, and they gave me a copy of it.
Sounds good.
And what time is it again?
Whatever time you finish, like 5, 5:30, I'll just have somebody here call me when y'all are heading that way, and I'll order the pizzas.
Okay.
That's 1 hour and a half?
Yes, it's 90 minutes in the film.
Okay. All right, let's have our, we're going to take a break, but we're now going to do the mantra of the New Group of World Service. This will be our mid-time for that. And I before saying that, well, we'll have our service, so we'll have a chance to say whatever we need to say. But for some of you who will not be here, it's good to get together to go over essential matters, you know, and really put the light of concentration on things that we might just skip over in our busy lives otherwise, and really submit to rigorous analysis the instruction we're getting from the master teacher.
Maybe it would be a good moment to say that when the next meeting is going to be, because it's already structured from 24th to 28th.
It's going to be the very end of February or the beginning of March.
It's 24th to 28th of February.
Is that when it is, actually?
Yes.
Okay, we actually went over that. We did go over that, didn't we?
Yeah.
We did that.
We marked and we agreed to that on from Wednesday to...
What are the dates?
24 to 28, and in fact, the
27th,
you will be doing the full moon. It's around the full moon.
Oh, that's why I have
be
to be here.
Doing the full moon meditation
I have to give a talk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back at the mouth.
Right.
Direct invitation from Tom Carney. Life changes. It was. But Tom was my contact. And then, you know, like, okay. Life changes. One of two dates, and this is the only one that did work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, which day is that for more?
Saturday.
I don't want that. Zobi, pause. What's going on? How do I get rid of this?
And so, Michael, to get oriented, are you planning to that be the last one, or are you planning to come more, or you don't know yet, or...
Yes, I would say I don't know yet.
I know. He says no, this is it, but it is not the truth.
That's right.
So you can still work in your mind that this is going on.
We have not finished the stanzas of Zian, you know.
Well,
we also...
And initiation,
there's something about cosmos that remains to be done.
There's other books, too.
Yeah.
What are you, a glutton for punishment?
A couple of things.
Everybody who wants to do that should make the commitment to go to Finland for those classes.
Ah. See, there. Okay, and you'll be among the first.
You are the
deliverer.
Thank you. Yeah. We actually could have longer things there, like 1 month.
Yeah.
In January.
Yeah, in January.
That's a supernal light, though. We can really use that.
So that is perfect.
Well, in summer, yes. In January, it is.
There's no light.
What is this? Eternal light.
Supernal light.
Oh, that's supernal light.
Even helps it.
Oh, there we should go.
Well, so we communicate by email if it happens another one, so we can find the time in October, November, whenever.
Well, the world can change very much. We'll just see, you know. I mean, you know, we can visit the California Islands. It's okay. I don't think those things will be upon us immediately.
Yeah, we'll be the new Hawaii.
Okay, well, I'm glad we have that down, and then afterwards, it looks like then we probably have to go to Escondido, probably afterwards. Yeah. Well, we'll see. Yeah, because I remember we had to do it this way in order to make the meditation mouth work out. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, let's have our mantra of the New Group of World Service, and then I don't know if there's any instructions about this room that you want to tell.
Just make it like earlier.
Okay.
The chairs in the in the circle.
And as you're moving, please be aware of equipment and other things so no accidents happen. Okay, thank you everyone.